Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Thunder Buddies podcast. I am Eric Horn here at the Oklahoman Studios in Oklahoma City with columnist Barry Trammell and our special guest today, wrapping up the Northwest Division, is Jason Quick of The Athletic. He writes about the Portland Trailblazers. He's done so for about 20 years, huh, Jason?
Yeah, this will be my 21st year.
Man, that's crazy. I hope that I can eventually get to the point to where I write about NBA basketball for 20 years or anything for 20 years. I'm still relatively young in my career. But, Jason, thanks for joining us on the podcast, man.
You bet, man.
Oh, what's it been like for you this summer, just to kind of jump right into it with the Blazers? Because, you know, this is a team that handled the Thunder pretty easily in that first round. And you look at the roster from the end of that series to now, and it's a lot has changed, and I think it's going to change a lot of the way that the Blazers kind of approach this season. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, you know, in those 21 years of covering the Blazers, this season, this upcoming season, probably has as much, if not more, anticipation than at any time during those 21 years. I mean, there was the time coming off of the Game 7 loss to the Lakers where people were pretty optimistic and had a lot of kind of anticipation for the year. But this year, after the Blazers went to the Western Conference Finals, they made a ton of moves. There's going to be they lost 7 guys, 6 new guys come in, and people really think great things are ahead for this team. So there's a ton of buildup, and people are really excited for this season. And, you know, I think it's somewhat justified, but it's so hard to tell when you have so many new people coming in. But the main thing is they have their two stalwarts coming back, Lillard and McCollum, and they feel like with those two, they're track record is so proven that you're going to be okay with those guys leading the charge.
Yeah, well, I mean, Jason, when I think of the Blazers and where they're at, I think back to a few summers ago when LaMarcus Aldridge jumped to San Antonio, and it looked like he had left the Blazers in really a bad spot. And Portland, to its everlasting credit, chose not to wave the white flag but to trudge on. How difficult was that decision to just ride Damon Lillard and see how far those Blazers could go? And it's obviously was the correct call. They've done wonderfully, but how treacherous was that time when they had to decide whether to start rebuilding or keep fighting?
Yeah, Barry. I mean, that was tough times. I mean, they didn't just lose Aldridge. They lost 3 other starters: Wesley Matthews, Robin Lopez, Nicholas Batum. So they had Lillard and a bunch of no names, really. But to Lillard's credit and to the people they signed, that team, I think Vegas projected they would win 26 wins, and they went and won 44 in advance of the second round. And that is really a testament to Lillard. Lillard is – he's a really unique individual. I know that gets thrown around a lot and has become cliche, but – the way he changes those guys' minds in the locker room and kind of wills them to believe in themselves and to get more out of themselves, it's really powerful. And it's really powerful when you're close to it on a day-to-day level. He is so positive, and he's so present. It's not all about him. And he notices when Mo Harkless is starting to pout a little bit, and he'll sidle up to him and go, "What's going on?" And, you know, Mo will say, "I'm not getting the ball enough." "Okay, let's try to figure out ways to get you the ball." And so, you know, little fires are put out because he's so observant and he's so about the team. And that's why I think it's really a positive as all these new guys come in. And it's interesting. One of the most intriguing parts about this new Blazers team is Hassan Whiteside, who was kind of labeled a malcontent in Miami, had some troubles with the coach, went in and out of the rotation because of attitude and performance issues. And when the Blazers traded for him, Lillard immediately called him, texted him, and said, look, this is the way we do things. You have to respect the coach. If you have problems, you come to me, and we'll talk it out, and we'll try to handle it. And I thought it was interesting. A couple weeks ago, I was at the arena, and I was doing something with Bill Walton, and we did an interview in the Blazers locker room. And of the new configured lockers, smartly put Hassan Whiteside right next to Damian Lillard. And I think that's by design, because they want Lillard to constantly be in this guy's ear, be able to be a resource to him, and to potentially put out any fires. So a long-winded way to answer your question, Barry, was, yeah, it was a really trying time in the summer of 2015, but the reason they came out of it so well was because of the leadership of Lillard. And that's why I think heading into this season, even though there's a lot of question marks and some guys are going to have to step up, I think Lillard is the man to kind of point them in the right direction.
Jason, you mentioned guys having to step up, and that's a perfect segue for me, because I was reading your story on Zach Collins and, you know, how he injured himself over the summer and the kind of the bond he has with his father. But, you know, you think about Zach Collins as a guy who really, in the Thunder-Portland series, he wasn't as effective as he was later on in the playoffs, particularly against Denver. And there were a lot of guys who were more effective in the later series, you know, Evan Turner, Collins are guys that come to mind, even Rodney Hood. You know, when you lose Mo Harkless and Al-Farouq Aminu, those were two guys that were uniquely – they were unique forwards for their position in that they could guard a multitude of players, particularly the way that they defended Paul George. Mo Harkless was really good on him, even though Paul George had some injuries in that series. But how important and how is this team going to look differently that they don't have those two 6'8", 6'9", guys that can guard a variety of different forwards? Is Collins capable of that? You know, how much are they going to need from a Rodney Hood? And what's going to look differently there with Harkless and Al-Farouq Aminu gone?
Yeah, that's kind of one of the top stories going into this season is Zach Collins is going to he's going to be the starting power forward, and that's going to be a big ask of him. But this team is very, very high on him, even though, you know, I think nationally you look at his stats, I think he was somewhere around 6 points and 4 rebounds last year, something like that. And you go, huh, that's not very good. But he's another one of those guys that if you watch him every day, you walk away impressed with him. And the number one thing about him is he's a plus defender, if not an exceptional defender. So I don't think they'll lose a lot defensively with him. And then offensively, I think he's going to be a decent three-point shooter. I think he shot around 33% from there last year. But the big thing with him is he's always been in foul trouble. He gets a ton of silly fouls, knick-knack fouls. He's got to clean that up to be able to stay on the floor. But they're asking a lot of him. And typically in the Blazers' history under Terry Stotts, they're great at player development. In the third year, players have had breakout seasons, from Alan Crabb to C.J. McCollum, Pat Connaughton, Will Barton. All these guys in their third year kind of take a big leap after they've been in the system and been developed by this assistant coaches and Terry Stotts. So they're kind of anticipating Collins will make that third year jump. But you're right. An underappreciated thing nationally, I think, of the Blazers last year was kind of the cohesiveness and the teamwork of Mo Harkless and Al-Farouq Aminu as defenders on the wing. They were switched. They could switch and were really interchangeable. And so they're going to lose that a little bit of that chemistry. Rodney Hood is kind of projected to step in and be the starting small forward now. Rodney had a great – after the Oklahoma City series, he had a great playoffs against Denver and Golden State. So I think with him knowing everything as far as the system and playing with Dame and CJ, what that's like, I think he's only going to be better this year. So I think they're going to be okay there. Another kind of wild card player who's going to be asked to do a lot more is Anfernee Simons, who's...
That was the next guy I was going to ask you about, was Anfernee Simons.
Just a teenager. He's was a first-round pick the year prior, 24th overall pick, came straight out of high school. Well, he was in the IMG program down there in Florida. And this team is so high on him. Matter of fact, I think it's almost dangerous how much they are touting Anfernee Simons as kind of the next big great thing. But this started early last year where veterans like Evan Turner and Mo Harkless were coming up to me and going, this kid is killing it in practice. This kid should be playing right now. But he could never get on the court last year because, well, they got Dame and CJ and Evan all handling the ball. And you know, they weren't really in a position. The Blazers weren't really in a position to be giving developmental time to guys like that during the regular season. But now they are giving him the reins to the second unit. He'll play a lot of point guard, and this kid's a scorer. I think he scored 37 points in the season finale, and that's why Portland got ended up matching with Oklahoma City. But the big question with him is going to be defense. Can he play any defense? And so far, he's been kind of a below average defender from what little we've seen. But if you're in a fantasy league or something, this guy is a sleeper because he's going to come out and score the ball. There's no doubt about it.
Hey, Jason, one guy we haven't mentioned, he seems fairly integral to the Portland success, and that's Terry Stotts.
Yeah.
How important? What's Terry's mark on this organization and these teams of recent years as the Blazer head coach?
Well, he's beloved here in Portland, and the players love playing for him. And his big thing is he gives the players the freedom to decide if it's a good shot, to decide, you know, if they make the extra pass. He's big on playing on instinct. And a lot of his offense, there's not set design plays. It's you guys run, you do picks, you keep moving, and you hit the open man. And it's built on a lot of trust. And I think NBA players really flourish with that kind of system where you're not going to get yelled at for taking an open shot. And that's his philosophy is if you're open, then it's a good shot. So he's done a lot of that. And he's also very open to the guys. You know, like if they are tired and they say, man, we need a day off, or I don't think we should shoot around. He does that. So there's a lot of input, but mostly I think from an offensive standpoint particularly, he really gives these guys a lot of ownership into what's going on. And you know, at the end of the day, a lot of times they have no one to look at them but themselves because they were the ones making the decision. It's not just a regimented offensive playbook where this guy's getting the ball here, this guy's going to shoot here. It's everyone feels a part of it. And at the end of the day, I think that makes it feel more like a team.
It sounds a lot like Billy Donovan. I was kind of mouthing that to Barry as you said, you know, giving players kind of some of that autonomy. It mm-hmm. sounds the way that Billy Donovan kind of conducts his offense. I mean, he wants movement and he wants ball movement and player movement, but he also gives guys, you know, the leeway to say, look, if that's an open shot you're comfortable with, take it. And particularly he did that with Russell Westbrook. I mean, to me, the biggest difference in the series was Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum were better shot makers than Russell Westbrook and Paul George. And that was, I mean, that was pretty obvious with the way that Damian Lillard put them out of the playoffs. I don't know where I was going with that, but I basically just wanted to bring up the fact that Russell Westbrook can't shoot. That's pretty much what I wanted to bring up. but no, I mean, Dame was awesome in that series. I think there might have even been a little bit of fatigue when it came to him when it came in the next series. What did you think about that series against Denver and what Portland was able to accomplish there? considering that, you know, those teams were so evenly matched and it went seven games. What did you think was the difference in the series for them being able to overcome Denver?
Well, first of all, I think more so than the sweep in the Western Conference Finals to Golden State, the Denver series really shaped the way Portland approached its offseason, because the way Denver trapped Lillard, they trapped him, but they also kind of had a third guy shadowing him, and they basically left Al-Farouq Aminu wide open. And the Golden State did the same thing. And so I think Portland realized that, man, Al-Farouq Aminu, he's a really valuable guy. He's really a glue guy for 82 games. But when you get in the playoffs, he's not so valuable, and he's actually kind of a detriment. So I think they realized that we need to get shooters around Lillard so they can't take a third guy and have him play center field while two other guys trap him. So that's why they went and got Bazemore. That's why they went and got Anthony Tolliver. They wanted to surround him with more shooters and that is not so much designed for the regular season, but designed for a long, deep playoff run. But to answer your question, I don't know that there's one thing that put them over the top in that series other than CJ McCollum had an absolute phenomenal game seven. I mean, if they didn't have CJ making just really high level shots in high pressure times, they don't win that game. And then Evan Turner came up big when Rodney Hood went down with an injury. So I think their depth really kind of came through in that series, but also as so happens in you know, long drawn out series, you just need a guy who can make shots on his own, because the defense becomes such a grind that you just need a guy who can make shots that other guys can't. And that was CJ McCollum in game seven. He was absolutely brilliant. I think that's why that game earned him the $100 million extension this summer. That series was so razor thin close. It was really a joy to watch.
Yeah, the Thunder definitely didn't trap Lillard with as much frequency as Denver did in that series. Yeah. But I thought the times that they did try and trap Lillard, they frankly just weren't very good at it. Like, Lillard would split the trap, and he would just be able to dribble through it. And then the times that they left him ISO on Paul George, he was just like, well, I'm going to just pull up from 35. And right. And then Russell Westbrook, by the end of the series, Russell Westbrook just didn't want any part of it. And that was kind of one of the things that you kind of pointed to in the regular season when you're watching the Thunder is, yeah, they're a good defensive unit, but how is Russell Westbrook going to be able to defend guys in the postseason? Is he going to be locked in on every possession? And I think that proved that he wasn't, or he just wasn't capable of doing so. When you go up against these teams like Golden State and Portland that have guards that can punish you on every play, It bears itself out. It bears out in the postseason, and that's beaten the Thunder, you know, I guess consecutive playoffs now, because Donovan Mitchell did the same thing to him, you know, a couple of playoffs ago.
Yeah, I don't know if my take on this is entirely accurate, but just from afar and from kind of the Portland lens, it seemed to me that it was too individual for Russell, and it was too much about he was so focused on winning his matchup and doing whatever he wanted to do against Dame, whereas I think Dame had a more team-wide approach to, hey, okay, forget all this one-on-one nonsense and who's tougher, who does this or that. It's about us and about the team. And you know, I'm sure Oklahoma City people feel probably differently, but that was kind of the impression I left that series with, is that it became too personal for Russell. Whereas I think Portland had a pretty broad not broad, but a narrow focus that all that outside stuff doesn't matter. It matters about winning the series.
I think that some of that creeps in, and I think you saw some of that actually in the series against Utah, in the final game of the 17-18 season, when Westbrook took 19 three-pointers in the closeout game in Utah. But I think, I think about that all the time. It's ridiculous. Paul George is terrible in that game too. But I also think about game one in Portland, because Westbrook played about as well as he could possibly play offensively. He was really good. And Jeremy Grant and Terrence Ferguson and Dennis Schroeder just did not hit any shots. Right. And I think that when Westbrook has games like that, it could send him into a mode like, well, I have to do this much everything to be able to compensate for these guys missing shots. And eventually they came home and they made some more shots. But the defensive part was always a glaring issue, more so than the offense to me for Russell. And because his shot just wasn't working all season, so he had to be able to do well in other areas to be able to compensate for his shot not working. But I do see what you're talking about. I do think that sometimes he had a tendency to do that. And the problem is you can't get into a shooting match with Damian Lillard. I mean, there's not many people in the league that are going to be able to beat Damian Lillard in a shooting contest.
Speaking of Lillard shooting, let me ask you, Jason. NBA shots that I'm not a part of, games I'm not covering, whatnot. When I think back, one of the memorable ones to me was Lillard's three-pointer deep ball that beat Houston. I think it was 14 playoffs. Uh-huh. Famous shot, knocked off the Rockets. And then, of course, we saw the 38-footer over Paul George last April. In Portland lore, when all of Rip City in its collective mind thinks about the greatest shots in Portland history, or even just the Damon Lillard greatest shots, how do those two rank?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I think – well, because the one against the Rockets, that put Portland into the second round for the first time in 14 years. And if he didn't hit that, they would have lost and had to go to Houston for game 7. So I'm going to say that one, because the Oklahoma City one, if he didn't make that, they were going to overtime. But as far as just the histrionics involved with it, the waving by to Russell Westbrook after he hit it, and the pandemonium after. I don't know. They're both incredible, incredible shots that will be replayed here forever. But I still think the 2014 one was bigger, just because it got them in the second round for the first time in a long time, and because if he didn't make that, they would have lost the game.
Jason, are you going to miss Enes Kanter? Miss him. No?
No. No.
Do explain.
No.
Do explain.
This is the end of a beautiful friendship right here.
Oh, I'm not.
The state of Oklahoma has just state of Oklahoma has just declared war on Jason Quick.
No, I think he's full of it. I think he's fake. I'm sorry, I do. The thing is, he gave a lot to this franchise, and I think he should be commended for playing through a hurt shoulder through the playoffs. But I think he really milked it up and overplayed it to a degree, and then the way he left here, saying that the Blazers only gave him, I forgot how much time he said.
What did he say, like 2 minutes? Was it 2 minutes?
Yeah, something like that. Where he had, the minute they signed him in February, he knew exactly how much money they were going to have in free agency. You know, they had so much money tied up that the most they were going to be able to give him was 5.7, the mid-level,
right,
the taxpayer's mid-level. And so, you know, he had essentially 2 months, 3 months to decide whether he wanted to go. And then he said they only gave him a couple minutes, which is laughable.
Yeah, Enes does have a propensity to, kind of, go to a team and you know, talk about his loyalty and how much he's committed to this and that, and how much he loves the city and all the places he's always in, and then and then do his thing. I love him. despite yeah, his despite his wavering loyalties.
Yeah.
But I gave you a little bit of homework, Jason, for the Western Conference. Did you do your homework?
I did.
Excellent, man. Let's just run through it real quickly. We'll start with your first eight. Where do you see the top eight teams? And obviously, this is an exercise in futility. People are going to get hurt. Trades are going to happen. But we're just going to have fun and just humor people with it for since I've done this with some previous writers on the podcast. What do you see the top eight in the Western Conference looking like?
Okay, I got one being Utah.
Interesting. That's the first number one Utah we've had of all the writers we've had on the podcast so far this summer.
Yeah. Two, the Clippers.
Okay.
Three, Denver. Four, Portland.
Okay.
Five, Houston. Six, Golden State.
Oh, no Lakers yet.
Yeah.
Seven, love it. The Lakers.
Okay.
Eight, the Spurs.
Got it. I think I had all the same teams in the playoffs, but the Utah one is fascinating. What gives you the sense that Utah is going to jump to one and that Denver, I mean, wouldn't be a very big fall. I had Denver number one and the Clippers two, but that the Denver will be the three seed.
I like the way Utah plays defense. Mm-hmm. I think that translates well over the regular season to getting wins. I think the only thing that that team has been missing over the years is solid point guard play. And I think I'm a huge Mike Conley fan. I think he is so underrated and will push them over the top. And I think it has been shown that the guys who play in FIBA come back, start well, and have big seasons. And the Jazz have Ingles, Gobert, Mitchell. So I think three of their main guys are really going to be kind of poised to have really good seasons, particularly early. So I think they get off to a good start. The Clippers, I think just with them rest, you know, we don't know how good Paul George is going to be right out of the bat, out of the gate. They're going to be resting Kawhi. They got to get used to people. But Denver, that was tough. I did think about Denver in that one, two, or three. But I don't know. I'd put them at three. I do like Denver, though. Like them a lot.
Your FIBA comment is interesting from the standpoint of, you know, one of the guys I thought that's just destroyed FIBA was Bogdanovich from the Kings. He's been awesome. And if the Kings are going to make, you know, another jump, I know they were pretty far off the eight seed, and I guess we'll get into your bottom eight next, but, you know, they're going to need guys like that to come back and shoot the ball really well and for them to defend really well. And that guy, man, he was – if I had to put together like an all-FIBA team, he'd probably be on it first team right now because he destroyed the Americans today. I mean, he's been awesome throughout the tournament. So he's probably going to come back and – you know, be one of those guys that carries over from FIBA and starts the season really well.
Yeah, I had the Kings at nine. And the only reason I had San Antonio ahead of them was just kind of the experience factor. And I think Murray coming back to the Spurs is really going to be a stabilizing force and really going to help their defense. So it was that was a real toss-up eight and nine with San Antonio and Sacramento.
Who are your other who are your others in the bottom eight of the Western Conference, the bottom seven, rather?
Nine, Sacramento, 10, Oklahoma City, 11, Dallas, 12, Minnesota, 13, New Orleans, 14, Memphis, and 15, Phoenix.
New Orleans at 13. That's the one that kind of stood out to me because I really like their roster. I don't know about how it's going to mesh together, but you've got a lot of guys from the Lakers who played together. You got a good mix of veterans and young guys because you got J.J. Redick and Favors, Drew Holiday, and then that's even before you get to anything that Zion brings to the table. Why do you have New Orleans at 13 as opposed to a little bit higher?
I don't know. No real reason. I still think like Lonzo Ball. I don't really trust him yet, just health wise, and So point guard's kind of iffy there for me, although I'm a huge Drew Holiday fan after watching what he did to Portland 2 years ago. I probably should, you know, in retrospect, I probably should have, I forgot they had Favors, actually, until you just said it. So I probably should have them higher, certainly ahead of Minnesota. But I think Dallas is going to be better than people think. And I think Oklahoma City is going to be better than people think. I still think there's a lot of talent there.
What do you like about the Thunder?
I like that young point guard a lot. Shea, and then I think Gallinari is a great shot maker. I love Steven Adams in the middle. And then you guys, you guys lost Grant. I don't know. I just think there's still some talent there. And Chris Paul can play. I don't think Chris Paul will last the whole season there, though. I think I'm hearing that they're still going to trade him to Miami, but we'll see. But I still think there's talent there.
Yeah, it, for the Thunder, it just depends on how long they're able to keep all those guys together. And then another guy is Danilo Gallinari, who really it doesn't make any sense for them to keep him the entire season considering he's going to be a free agent. And yeah, he's just such a good shooter. People are going to want to trade for that, and they're going to be able to get something for him. So it's really a matter of when it comes to the Thunder and how long they really want to remain competitive this season. But it's the teardown is coming. It is imminent.
What's their opening night starting lineup?
Oh, let's see. Adams at center, Gallinari at power forward. The three is the question. I feel like it's going to be Ferguson because I don't think Andre Robertson is going to be as good of a player as Ferguson on opening night, or he'll even be ready. We're not sure. And then you'll probably have a combination of Gilgeous Alexander and Chris Paul in the backcourt.
Yeah.
Which is a good starting lineup. I mean, that's a solid starting lineup. And their bench isn't terrible either. You know, you got a good mix of veterans and youth coming off the bench. And if you get Robertson back to start the season, that's an X factor. So it can be a competitive team. It's just a matter of how long does the Thunder feel like they really need to be competitive before that deal comes that they want to make to get Gallinari and Chris Paul on their way.
All right.
Final little exercise we want to do here before we leave. I proposed this to Barry before we came on the podcast. Let's fix FIBA. And I'm talking about it from an American standpoint. And fix is kind of a relative term. I'm going to look at this as what would be the best format for USA Basketball to use the FIBA tournament for the Olympics for. Not necessarily how do we win FIBA, how do we win the Olympics? We've done that before. These guys don't prioritize it like they used to. These guys just want other people to essentially do the dirty work so they can slide into the Olympics and win the thing that really matters. So what do we want out of FIBA?
Let me ask you two guys a question because you know more about it than I do. The Europeans, those that are playing in the NBA and those that are playing in the EuroLeague, where does FIBA rank in priority compared to their professional job?
Higher. It's the highest thing for them to play for their country.
It is high. It's higher. Yes. It's higher.
Yes.
Okay. Then the American problem with FIBA is not fixable.
Yeah.
It's not fixable.
Right.
Because it's not the highest priority here. So, and I'm not. I would argue it shouldn't be. And I would argue that it shouldn't
so
be.
So what you do in order to quote-unquote fix it, because I don't know if it is fixable, is you take the Olympic model. And this isn't – I'm not the first person to propose this. And essentially, the Olympic model for, say, like soccer, is it's an under-23 tournament where you're only taking players 23 or younger, and you have maybe three slots for designated players that can go over age.
Why would the world agree to that?
Not the world. I'm just talking about you. This is just the USA. A strictly U.S. policy.
So the U.S. would just send a young team.
Yes.
To play against Rudy Gobert.
And then you'd have a certain amount of slots that would be designated for players that could go over slot and be 27.
And what's that supposed to fix?
But again, like I'm saying, it's relative. You're not necessarily – it depends on what you consider the quote-unquote fix. If the fix is getting guys who are motivated to play international basketball – that's a better fix than saying whatever else the other fix might be. Because
I don't know that there is a – I guess. I mean, if France is going to have Rudy Gobert and the Americans are not going to send their, you know, their best players, they're not going to win.
Yeah.
Rudy Gobert is not going to let them score. So I don't know how you fix that.
Jason?
I don't know that there is a fix because it's kind of entrenched in our minds here in America that, hey, we're the best in the world at basketball. I mean, does anyone care about that we lost two straight games at FIBA? I don't.
Yeah, I don't either.
You know, who cares? You know, we still know we have the best players. So until, you know, the Bradley Beals and LeBron James and, you know, Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, until it matters to them that they're losing overseas, there is no fix. It's the motivation has to come from within. And I don't know that there is an answer until they lose so much or other people start considering other countries better and they feel like they have something to prove. But I don't think that's ever going to come because we all know that the Americans have the best players. It's a fact.
You know, Jerry Colangelo had some interesting comments today after the loss, and he basically alluded to they're not going to forget all the guys who dropped out leading up to this. I don't believe him, but like if LeBron James comes back in a couple months and says, hey, I want to play in the Olympics and I want to be a part of the process going into the Olympics, they're not going to turn LeBron James down. So what do you all think about the U.S. kind of going forward into the Olympics, or if y'all even care, if they go forward into the Olympics with, you know, a group of guys that is similar to what they went to FIBA with and guys that were a part of the qualifying process, you know, your younger guys like Marvin Bagley's and such?
Well, I think the Olympics has a higher appeal than the FIBA World Cup, you know. So I don't think it'll be a problem getting players for the Olympics. It's these World Cups that's where they run into the problem.
Well, yeah. Well, like, but
and maybe one of the fixes is to say, hey, you can't play in the Olympics until you play X amount of games in the World Cup.
And let me ask another question here.
Okay.
Americans clearly care about the Olympics. We care about the Olympics.
Yes.
The American sporting public, the marketplace. We don't really care about the World Cup.
No.
We don't care about FIBA.
And the players know that too.
Yeah. So are we just sort of sitting here talking about a problem that really isn't a problem, I guess, is my
question. Well, that's the thing. Yeah. The quote-unquote fix. What are we quote-unquote fixing? Is anything even really broken?
Who cares? Because there's a whole – some people care about the Olympics. Some of us are like me, and we don't even like this whole nationalism stuff that goes with sport.
Yeah.
I like the Olympics except when it comes to team sports. I don't want to watch a team sport. I don't want to watch – the Dream Team play Angola? That's not sport to me.
Look, I'm going
to
be frank. I don't wake up on the weekends during the summer of the Olympics and say, ooh, I got to watch Team USA today. South Korea.
I love the swimming. I mean, I love the track. I love all the individual stuff. But the team stuff drives me nuts.
So, you know what? You know what's interesting to me, though? I would actually be more interested in watching Team USA basketball if I knew we didn't have the best team in the world. If it was a bunch of college kids or it was a bunch of younger Americans.
Well, you can't send, in the old days, you could send a college team. You can't send and do that anymore.
But
what if you did, you know, so you're saying send a young team. Send
my Olympic interests.
Like the sophomore team, like the NBA All-Star game where the sophomores used to play do they still do that? The sophomores play the freshmen? Yeah. The rookies against the second-year guys?
Yeah, rookies, sophomore. But my interest in American Olympic success at the team level peaks when it's an American team that's not the best and I get to see them kind of achieve together. It's kind of like when our gymnastics teams, for instance, go up against the Chinese or the Russians or the Ukrainians, and I'm like, oh, well, we're not the clear favorite, or at least that happened at least in the last 20 years. Our last women's team was dominant. But when I can watch those American teams that aren't the best kind of come together and achieve, the one that comes to mind is like the Winter Olympics hockey team we had, and obviously America has a great hockey program, but like when they went against Canada in the gold medal game, I guess it was maybe in the last decade, that was awesome. Like, that was awesome to watch. Like, the American hockey team versus Canada, like, yeah. That was fun.
I mean, you two guys are too young to remember 1980, but 1980 was like special.
Pressure. Yeah.
That was special.
I wasn't too young, Barry.
Oh, well, I'm trying to catch you a break there. But anyway, yeah, I guess it's a problem for people in basketball, but I don't think the American marketplace cares.
Nope.
And that's why we're not going to get the best players going to the Olympics anymore. All right.
That's okay.
Last thing, Jason, I'm going to put you on the spot. What do you think about Kevin Durant, man?
What do I think about Kevin Durant? He has... he's gone down in my book, I guess I would say, since he has left Oklahoma City. I still hold him in very high regard as a basketball player, but he seems overly sensitive and bitter, and I get it. So I don't know him at all. I've never spoken to him through all these years. But he just seems overly sensitive.
Yeah, you know, his comments in the Wall Street Journal have obviously gotten a lot of traction around here just because of, you know, his relationship with Oklahoma City. But, I mean, I tend to find myself always coming back to this thing in the last 3 years. Like, he just needs to stop talking. And Barry kind of wrote about him this week about being, you know, a troubled soul. And I think
he's depressed. He's got classic depression to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot out there about, you know, after he won his first title. And I don't want to misquote anybody, but I think people have talked about after he won his last title, he was still looking for something, or he felt like, is this it? So he's obviously searching for something. He was looking for it here. He was looking for it in Golden State. He's probably still going to be looking for it in Brooklyn. And you just hope that a guy like that can find some peace somewhere to where he's not, you know, continually coming back to these things and changing the narratives of the details around these stories. But as you said, Jason, phenomenal basketball player. He's just a very just strange mind. Anyhow, let's wrap it up on that. Kevin Durant. He's not. Okay, I will say this. Kevin Durant's not going to be able to play basketball for like a long time. I don't think it's going to get better for him.
He's probably going to sit on his couch with his five phones going through all his social media accounts. That's probably what he's going to do.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Kyrie Irving's going to be doing Kyrie Irving things.
Yeah.
That's going to be a very interesting experiment. Jason, thanks for joining us, man. Thanks for coming on the podcast. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. We greatly appreciate it. Looking forward to seeing you throughout the season.
Yep, you bet. Look forward to it, guys.
See you, Jason.
And thanks, everyone, for joining us on the Thunder Buddies podcast. Thanks for sharing, listening, downloading on Apple Podcasts. And we will see you sometime before preseason to give you some preseason preview going into the season. And I'm not going to put a date on that because I don't know yet. But we'll certainly be here in the next couple weeks. Thanks again for listening.